Group meeting, Saturday, 4th July, 1981. The question is, does the word effort, in its profoundest sense, have any validity in the religious life? I'll read it again. Does the word effort, in its profoundest sense, have any validity in the religious life? Now, this immediately raises up another question. What do we here, you and I, understand by the religious life? What is the religious life? Is it something opposed to or strongly contrasted with the secular life? Or is it and should it be rooted in the secular life? Except that a process of transformation of the nature of the secular life takes place if we live our everyday life in the truly religious sense. Now, this would imply that what we see as the, or what we might be able to see as the context of religion, the true context of religion, plays its full part. And as we have often said, the context of religion is transcendence. And transcendence must be understood as completely subsuming all the world. The context of the world is finite, it is temporal, and thereby it is mortal. It comes into being, proceeds, and passes away. Birth and death are involved in it. The context of transcendence is the infinite, the eternal, and the immortal. Now, I talk in terms of two concepts purely for the convenience of using the English language, or any language for that matter, to try and understand this matter. The two contexts are really one whole context. But it is impossible to talk in terms of a single context, because all talking implies the relationship between words and their meanings and ideas and so forth. And in the state of unitary wholeness, there is no such thing as separateness. There is no such thing as a subject looking at an object and trying to understand it. So we can't talk. Silence is the sphere of the transcendent, the real silence in every sense, you see. But the fact remains that if the sense of transcendence awakes or begins to awake in anyone, then he is sensitive to the fact that this context of the infinite, the eternal, and the immortal completely subsumes the finite, the temporal, and the mortal. But it is not the other way about. Because the infinite, eternal, and immortal can never pass away. It can never come into being. It is. That's that. There's an absoluteness about that context. Now, what is the purpose of religion? Or rather, what does religion imply for us? The word, from its Latin derivation, religare, means to bind back to, or to put into complete relationship with the source from which we come. Whatsoever conduces to that is religion. Whatsoever thought, feeling, word or action helps us to understand that and put it into practice and live in that way is living religiously. Now, if we understand this quite clearly, we can approach this question of effort. We know that in the ordinary way, in our everyday life, whatsoever we do calls for an effort. If we think, just think, sit and think, and if we are really thinking, that involves a mental effort. If we speak, it involves an effort. If we do anything, obviously, it involves an effort. And so effort has its place, and a very, very large place in our whole material, worldly life. Nothing can happen without effort. We may ask, why is that? We have been told in the religions that whatever was the primordial creative power or energy or God or Brahman or whatever word you like to use, just created the universe like that, effortlessly. Why should we have to put in an effort? This is an important point altogether. Because that which we aim to do, or that which we try to do, is done or takes place in terms of separate people or objects or situations which are brought together. They are synthesized, if you like, but they are brought together mechanically. Whatsoever happens mechanically in the context of mortality, therefore, of necessity requires effort. But whatever takes place in the context of the infinite and the eternal takes place effortlessly. In other words, the context of the transcendent is entirely self-subsisting and self-replenishing. The context of worldliness is not self-subsisting. It has to be maintained by action, by effort, by the use of energy and so forth. You see? Whereas the context of the immortal is of itself a perpetually self-replenishing energy at work. It is in action, in pure action, action in eternity, not in time, not subject to the constraints of mortality in any way. Now, if we begin not only to see this as a thought, but really sense it in the deeps of our own consciousness, we can understand why there is this apparently unbridgeable gulf between the worldly context and the transcendent context. The transcendent context, its action is as if it were pure magic, like we have in the scriptures, the different scriptures. And God said, or God desired, or the Atma or Brahman desired, and lo and behold, it was. I think out of the 4,000 millions of the earth, there would probably be only 4 people who wouldn't be so foolish as to want that for themselves here and now. That whatsoever they desire shall just suddenly appear. Because consider what sort of desires we do have. What are the things that we think are worthwhile? And so forth. All those questions come in. So now, we begin to see something of the the way in which we can understand whether effort has any validity in the religious life. If by the religious life one means the activity of the perfected Holy One, then effort has no validity there. You may say, but the perfected Holy One who is alive in this world is like any one of us, psychophysically, not psychically, but certainly physically, he is like one of us. And if he wants to cross the road, he has to make an effort to cross the road. True enough. But consider this matter very deeply. What is the state, what is the nature of the consciousness, the innermost consciousness of the perfected Holy One? Is it like our consciousness? Or is it a completely transformed consciousness? It is consciousness in a sense which is utterly different, but not opposed, utterly different from our sense of consciousness. Ours is a discriminative consciousness. We are aware of the other object, situation, event, person, thing, etc., etc. You see, there is always the otherness. I, the separate, isolated person, am conscious in terms of otherness. The perfected Holy One is not conscious in terms of otherness. There is no otherness in that consciousness. It is an all-pervading consciousness. Now do not therefore think that by all-pervading consciousness, if the perfected Holy One were here, he would know all about what you did at lunchtime or etc. Nothing of the sort. That doesn't enter into the situation at all, for the very simple reason that the things of man, of mortality, do not touch the things that are of God, as Jesus might have said. He might have used those words, you see. The consciousness of the perfected Holy One is a creative consciousness, continuously, perpetually. But it is not concerned with creating things or creatures in the sense in which things and creatures are made in this world. In the worldly context, everything is made. In the transcendent consciousness, there is only creative activity. A creation, a creative activity in eternity. And it is very important to realize this. This is the fundamental meaning of the word karma. This creative action in eternity. You know how Sri Krishna in the Gita says to Arjuna, if I did not constantly engage in action, O Arjuna, these worlds would fall into ruin. Now, we think of Krishna as a very special sort of gentleman who flourished in India. Well, I doubt whether there was any real person called Krishna. There may have been a perfected Holy One who would represent what Krishna is supposed to stand for. But the consciousness of a Krishna is the all-pervading creative consciousness. And because it is constantly creative, it maintains the entire universal process. And in the maintenance of that entire universal process, everything happens according to law. Law which is not laid down by a particular intelligence or a particular desire on the part of a lawgiver, but it is law which is inherent in all that which emerges in the creative activity. Now this is very difficult really to grasp. Don't look at it, or don't approach it too intellectually, analytically I mean, you see. Don't approach it analytically because it will get you nowhere. You have to be very quiet in your mind and sense this. When the mind is truly quiet, it is pure. And by mind in this context, I mean the psyche, not mind in its pure sense. If the psyche is perfectly calm and quiet, then there is that inner state of tranquility in which these things are, we have no other word to use, these things are seen. It is perhaps preferable to say these things are sensed. And if you sense that, then you will find that the consciousness of the Holy One, being a creative consciousness, functions effortlessly all the time. That which you are truly conscious of is already there with you, in you, and happens through you. Now, all of us human beings do have that kind of consciousness where our bodily life is concerned. When you and I were born, we couldn't stand, we couldn't run, we couldn't do anything like that, could we? But as we grew up, as life had its say in the right way, in terms of what we call the growth of our body, we were able to run, we were able to talk, we were able to do the things that we do. And we do it, as we say, quite naturally, don't we? Naturally and spontaneously. The actual running, the actual walking and so on, does mean the expenditure of physical energy, true enough. And we may call that an effort. But there is no effort in the sense of striving to do something which could not be done before. The body naturally and spontaneously walks, runs, sits, stands, and so forth. Now, it is in that sort of way that this inner consciousness of the Holy One functions. Therefore, it is a constantly creative, a constantly purifying consciousness. Wheresoever there is the Holy One, the atmosphere is purified. I don't mean that a fog would disappear, but the psychical atmosphere, the mental atmosphere which pervades the room is purified by His very presence, and even more so by His words, what He says. Because He speaks from that level, from the depth, that innermost depth of consciousness, which is utterly pure. And this consciousness, remember, is not a knowing consciousness in our sense of the word. We know only discriminatively. We know in terms of separateness, in terms of comparison, in terms of measurement, and so on. We evaluate, we judge, and so forth. No such thing happens with Him who is at home in this transcendent consciousness. There is no evaluation, there is no judgment. Therefore, there is also no condemnation. There is no reward from Him, there is no punishment from Him towards anybody else. What is there then from Him? Healing. Complete and total healing, whole making. Wheresoever He is, that region, that place becomes whole, purified, holy, and law in the sense of that which is inherent in the very being and structure of anything and everything functions easily, unobstructedly, and therefore, as we would say in worldly terms, comes to fruition, comes to perfection. Now all this seems to me to be involved in the living of the religious life, that it is this sort of thing towards which we are tending. But this is the supreme point, so to say, the ultimate fulfillment. There is something else in addition. We all use the word mind. Can you tell me what mind is? Can you present it to me on a silver salver? There is mind. Is it an organ, like your liver or your kidneys are organ? Is it your brain? This is a very important question, because it's something which has bedeviled the thinking of the 17th to the 19th century philosophers of the world. Is it your brain? The brain is the concretest bit of mind which functions in our own body. It is the indispensable apparatus for the functioning of mind. Mind in itself is an archetypal form of the primordial creative energy whose task is to release cosmos out of chaos. Mind is universal. You and I haven't got a mind. We have a psyche, yes. Psyche is ours, but not mind. Mind is something universal, just like space. Or to take a more concrete example, like air. The atmosphere of the earth is universal. Wheresoever you go, you'll be breathing the air. Except when you dive into water. True enough, you see. But mind is universal then. It's like space, like universal space. It is characterless. What is the characteristic of space? We don't know. There is no characteristic. It is characterless. It is space. It's a fundamental, a primordial, if you like. Similarly, mind is a fundamental. It is anidarsanam, as the Buddha said, without characteristics. It's anantam, endless, and therefore beginningless, therefore eternal, immortal. It cannot be born, it cannot die. That is mind. And it is this energy, this kind of specialized form of the one and only creative energy, the fundamental creative energy, which is responsible for the release of cosmos out of chaos, and a whole universe comes into being. So bearing that in mind, we can see that this primordial, this creative energy, which we call mind, universal creative energy, coming in contact with matter, and our bodies are material bodies, and matter itself is the ultimate concrete expression of the final concrete expression of the ultimate creative energy. So you see, the whole thing is a tremendous wholeness, a tremendous unitary wholeness, which is not very easy to get hold of purely by any intellection. We have to sort of let the psyche be quiet and calm, and then we can sense this. So when this energy, mind, comes in contact with the body, It is rooted, it gets rooted in the brain and nervous system and is in touch with the activity of the ductless glands. This is what gives rise to all our psychical functioning. Our thoughts and feelings and so forth, all what we call our mental life, our psychological life, is just this, due to our own psyche. We can definitely say my psyche or your psyche, but we cannot say my mind or your mind. What people commonly call my mind is just a whole collection of mental constructs which have come into being since infancy. Mental constructs, a whole box full of them. It's like an intellectual card index that we have, you see. And these concepts and so forth are indispensable for living in the world as psychophysical organisms, but they are indispensable because they are the means by which we recognize, recognize whatsoever is conveyed to us through our sense functions. We see an object, and because we have, through experience of so many percepts from infancy onwards, having seen trees, we have the name tree, and we have the concept tree in the brain itself. And so we say, oh, that's a tree. And if we know more about the subject, we say, oh, that's an apple tree or an oak tree or whatever it is. So this is how the whole thing happens. And one sees the relationship of pure mind as a creative energy to our mental processes, which are our ordinary psychical and mortal processes. The psyche dies with the body, completely and utterly. The entire psychophysical organism goes. It is not annihilated, but its specialized presentation in the world whilst we are alive is gone forever. Just like in autumn when the leaves fall, each leaf, which was a specialized presentation out of the one tree, is gone forever. It's completely gone. That leaf, any particular leaf, will never come back on its own thing. If you look at the human tree in that way, you will see that the popular picture of rebirth or reincarnation is a misleading and really rather an unfortunate picture to present. There is no such thing. The tree, because of its inner creative life, puts forth new leaves when the next season comes round. And when they fall, they too are finished as such. But whatsoever dies, whatsoever has been born and lived produces its impress upon the transcendent. The finite, the temporal, and the mortal leaves an impress upon the infinite, the eternal, and the immortal. And this impress manifests itself in a certain sort of change of consciousness, of this innermost depth of consciousness, from whence proceeds creative action. And when the particular person or animal or tree or whatever it is dead, as we say, it is gone forever and ever, but this impress upon the transcendent makes for the necessity for the transcendent to express another something. If and when you or I realize the perfect holiness, in other words, when we are in that condition where, like Jesus, we can say, I and my Father are one, or as in the Old Testament, people like Moses spoke to God face to face as a friend speaks to a friend. You see? If when that is the case, then there is no impress which is not in harmony with the transcendent nature of the totality, of that which is, the everlasting that which is. Then there is, now this was put in the this sort of language in India. Then there is no rebirth, they say. You don't come back to this world. But all these phrases, they have a significance up to a point, but they are misleading phrases. We have to progress all the time. Move on. You see, we believe in the scriptures of the world implicitly. But what do we believe in? The words that are written down. Those words are supposed to represent. Now remember, represent. To represent the unchanging eternal truth. All right. They may, up to a point, represent the unchanging eternal truth, just like a photograph of me represents what I look like, and so forth. All right? But it is only a representation. It is not the actuality as such. We have to remember that. Therefore, as the centuries pass and others come along and they get insights which can be expressed in clearer concepts and in more accurate verbal forms. All we can do is to, where conceptualizing and verbalizing is concerned, is to come nearer and nearer to making the expression of the truth be more like the truth itself. This is all that we can do. And this will go on as long as the human race exists on the globe. So we mustn't get imprisoned, tied by the words of Scripture. You know how in so many of the great scriptures they talk of the word, the creative word, the ma'amar of the Old Testament, of the Judaic teachings, the Ahuna Vairya of the Zarathustrians, St. John's Gospel, in the beginning was the Word, supposed to be the Word which brings the universe, world into being, and so forth, the creative Word. But what does this mean? It simply means that it is this creative energy, this primordial creative energy, which, functioning in eternity, produces the whole process. That is what it means. And this word in any language means, in the first instance, precisely what it does mean in the dictionary of that language. But it is always a restricted meaning. And we, when we read the word or hear a word, we give meanings to it. I am the giver of the meaning to the word. And I, being limited, being ignorant, being imperfect, naturally misrepresent the word with my meaning. So now, where are we as regards effort and its validity in the religious life? Our effort consists then in the process of the purification of the psyche. That purification enables one to realize psychophysically the state of perfect tranquility. Perfect tranquility, peacefulness within oneself. When that peacefulness within oneself has come to the critical point, that is to say the supreme point. After that, to bring it to that supreme point, one has to make the effort. And we'll talk about what the effort consists in very shortly. We have to make the effort to arrive at that point, and then it has become natural and spontaneous to us. It's like your natural born concert pianist or violinist or singer. First of all, there is the learning of the process, there's the practice, there is the effort put forward, until when the perfection of technique is there at the service of the inspiration from within, then that person's performance is effortless. We always say how easy it looks to us in the audience looking at the perfect performer. He's only got to do that, and lo and behold, wonderful beauty comes out. Well, if I were to do that for the next 150 years, no such beauty will come out. It's like that, you see. You reach that critical point, and then suddenly what is precipitated is the perfection. It's like in chemical reactions, you know, you come to a point where the substances reach the you come to a stage when the substances reach the critical point, and lo and behold, there is precipitated that which you are trying to make, to produce. It's something like that which happens. So this precipitation takes place, and then the living of the religious life is certainly effortless. But how do we bring this about, this arriving at this stage where this precipitation can take place? Obviously, all effort must be rightly directed. But what is the meaning of rightly directed? It's directed towards that which we see as the goal, or understand as the true purpose of our existence, and so forth. How do we get the vision of the true purpose of our existence? This again involves the quietness of the psyche. And the quietness of the psyche is helped by the quietness and healthiness of the body. If the body is truly healthy, then the psyche is also truly healthy. We all know the old Latin saying, mens sana in corpore sano. A healthy mind in a healthy body. But the unfortunate part of all expressions, verbal expressions, is that it involves a duality. A healthy mind, something different, in a healthy body, which is different from mind. The fact of the matter is that body-mind is a single thing. We are psychophysical. But the brain is an analyzer. The brain is like Mephistopheles, always making trouble. And the brain goes and separates these two. There is no need to separate the two at all. It's a wholeness. It's an organic wholeness. Our organic wholeness is purely psychophysical. It's not merely physical. So we have to have a vision, some sort of vision of the goal, of the direction in which life is moving us. Now this is rather important. Bear in mind, life moving us, not we trying to move life. We are such egoists, we are so vain, conceited, and all the rest of it, that we want to run the world. Thank goodness we can't. It's bad enough as it is. Without our trying to make the mess messier. So, by observing the ways of life in us and through us, And the body is a wonderful teacher, perhaps the most wonderful teacher that we have. You don't need to come and listen to Firoz Mehta or anybody at all, really. You listen to your own body as it speaks the truth to you. Provided you can hear, you're not deaf to the voice of the body. And you will find that you will get the sense of what is the right direction for you. And for you individually. Because we are all, every one of us is a unique individual. In past months we have talked about this uniqueness and what it is due to. I'll very briefly repeat that. The new child is formed by the union of two gametes, one in the mother, one in the father. The gametes are formed not only through the hereditary activities and influences in each person, because then we just have a repetition of the same thing all the way through if it was a case of mere reproduction in that sense, but by a reorganization of these hereditary factors at play. And then when the two gametes combine to form the zygote, which becomes the new child, you have a completely new individual. No one ever like him existed before. In the 3 or 4 million years of human history, no one like that is present living today, and no one like that living in the thousands and millions of years to come will be like this particular person. You are utterly unique psychophysically. Utterly unique. You see? So, your way is your individual unique way. Your individuality, in the sense that it represents your specialness, has to express itself, to come out. But beware of misinterpreting this. The misinterpretation would be that we think, oh, I am thus and thus and thus. But I do not really know myself. Can any one of us put his hand on his heart and say, I really know myself? No. We are imperfect creatures. We are so conditioned. We are so much under the domination of our desires and appetites, whims, passions, and misperceptions, and so on, that we have a false image of ourselves. Observe the processes in the brain as we experience our everyday life. All the sense experiences that come to us, all that emerges out of us in terms of memory, through memory, and our own particular desires, and so on and so on. Observe all that very carefully and don't grasp at anything that you see. Just let it be. Let it sink to the bottom of the well, so to say, you see. And that will enable true self-perception to come. And self-knowledge grows that way. And as self-knowledge grows that way, you will also be able to see precisely what is the direction in which life is moving you. Now, once you see that, and then beware of conceptualizing the goal, the direction. You will sense that, oh, I'm moving this way, you see, but you're moving with your eyes closed. Keep your eyes closed. Don't say, I'm moving precisely there. That will be the mistake. It is not for me to lay down what, to use theistic language, the Lord God wants me to do, to be and to do. It is not for me. It is for me just to be an open, sensible, unresisting vessel through which transcendence can function and move me. Otherwise, all the sorrows and the struggles and the sufferings of life come and make a mess of things for me. So don't conceptualize it. See it and have a certain sort of a general feel of it. I think that's the best way to put it. Get a general feel of that direction, and your vision of the goal will be the right sort of vision. Life itself in its totality has no goal. Anything in totality has no goal, no purpose. How could it? Purpose can exist only in terms of the relationship of this thing with an other thing. But where there is no otherness, in the complete holiness, the complete wholeness, there is no other thing. It is the unitary whole, the absolute whole. You see, it's like that. So, when you get this, when you have this general feel, you will be able to let your life flow in harmony with it. Let your life flow, meaning all your ordinary mental processes, your thoughts, your feelings, and so on. And you will know what to drop, what to let go. You don't have to overcome any evil or folly inside yourself. It just falls away by itself. When one sees this is wrong, this is an error, then what has taken its place as a result of that seeing? The truth has taken its place. The truth is the everlasting fact. Our misperceptions and follies and so forth are the dirt and the dust which we put upon the perfect beauty and perfection of the everlasting fact. So you see, that is the way we can go. And it will imply, it will involve, of course, constant awakenedness within oneself, watchfulness. Remember the words of Jesus, watch and pray. And the words of the Buddha, the Sammasati and the Sammasamadhi. They are the exact equivalent of watch and pray. And that way, one can reach that condition of that inner tranquility which keeps us absolutely peaceful, unperturbed, in a state of constant equanimity in the midst of any and every circumstance in life, pleasurable or painful. Don't cast aside pleasure or pain. If they come naturally, let them come. And that way, I think one can understand whether effort has validity in the religious life.